everybody.
Hi, friends.
And welcome to
The Bitchery of History.
My name is Max.
I'm Allison. And this week, I'm going to be talking to you about Mary Verghese.
And I'm going to be talking about Louise Bourgeois-Bourgier.
And I'm also going to be talking about Rebecca Crumpler.
Two women from Allison.
Get ready.
Look at that.
Short and sweet, both of them, but you're going to love it.
So ready.
So Mary Verghese, who I am going to start with, was born in India to a prosperous family. Her father was a respected teacher in the local community and in the church. And she was the seventh of eight children in her family. So very young through the rest of her siblings.
Right.
And Mary attended high school and then she went on to college and she got her graduate training in medicine at the Christian Medical College between 1946 and 1952. Now, she really was aspiring to specialize in gynecology and join that department. But while she was studying gynecology and working in that department, she was in a terrible car crash with a fellow student. You've seen Maniac. It's basically that. Like, the driver swerved around a big truck to try and pass, but there was a car in the oncoming lane, so then he slammed on the brakes, and it was a whole...
Oh, God.
It was, like, a really bad car accident.
Sure.
She's like, I can't be a doctor anymore.
Right.
Because I cannot walk anymore. Right. Because my spine broke in half, and so I have to be in a wheelchair.
Being a doctor, small amount of motor control that's needed.
Yeah, just a little bit. So her injuries were managed by Dr. Paul Brand, and after observing her downward spiral, he stopped by her room for a visit, and quote, according to this story, Mary, I think it's time to begin thinking of your professional future as a doctor. And at first she thought that he was joking, but he went on to suggest that she might bring to other patients unique qualities of sympathy and understanding.
Oh.
So she pondered this suggestion, and this is told in her biography / autobiography that's called Take My Hands, which was written by Dorothy Clark Wilson.
Okay.
So for a long time, she was really doubting whether she would ever recover sufficient use of her limbs to function as a doctor. But gradually, she began to work more, and then she began to work with leprosy patients. And the hospital staff noticed that the patient's self-pity, hopelessness, and sullenness seemed to fade whenever she was around.
What year was this?
In the 1950s, 60s, India as well. So leprosy, for those of you who don't know, it's sort of one of the biblical plagues, but it's a very scarring disease. Like it's not... You know, someone may be walking around with HIV or AIDS these days, and you may not really know. It doesn't present itself. Even cancer, you know, doesn't often present itself as a very obvious disease necessarily, depending on various factors. But leprosy is like, yup, you got scars.
And for such a long period of history, it was seen as a curse from God or a curse from, you know, whoever on high.
And a lot of times... leprosy patients are in wheelchairs. There's a whole book. There was a whole Hawaiian island that was like a leprosy concentration camp, basically. Like, it's a very stigmatized
history,
disease.
We have these little camps or colonies where they would just, okay, you have leprosy, something's wrong, you must be separated from the greater society.
So the leprosy patients whispered among themselves about the wheelchair doctor, the first in India, who was more disabled than they were, whose face like theirs bore scars. And before long, Mary began assisting at surgery, which is pretty exhausting work from a sitting position. I can't even sit down and cut vegetables. Like, I need to be standing. I'm also short, so that probably
just
part
a little
of the
bit.
Issue.
Yeah, sure.
And then one day, Dr. Brand met Mary rolling her wheelchair between buildings of the hospital and asked how she was doing. And she reports that she says, quote, "At first, the threads seem so tangled and broken, but I am beginning to think my life may have a pattern after all."
Look at that.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
So Dr. Brand subsequently became her mentor, and that's where she learned all the surgical skills related to leprosy rehabilitation. And Dr. Brand pointed out that she could sit in her wheelchair and operate on the hands of people with Hansen's disease. So very fine work. I mean, a hand operation is very intense.
Hands and feet are some of the most complicated.
Yep.
That's amazing. This is he gave her a new hope.
Exactly. She took a course.
That was a Star Wars reference.
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
I hope our listeners do too. She took a course of rehabilitation at the Australian Rehabilitation Center in Perth, and she secured a fellowship at the Institute of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, New York, under Dr. Howard Rusk, a pioneer in the field. And on completing her fellowship there in 1962, she returned to India to head the Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation at Christian Medical College, which is where she went to school.
Wow.
And she started the Rehabilitation Institute there in 1966 and headed the first fully functional physical rehabilitation unit in the country.
Wow. Is she still alive?
No, she passed away in 1986.
Wow.
But what a life.
Yeah, for real though. 1986, she did all that in 30 years or so.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Rebellions are built on hope. See, there we go.
That was a Star Wars reference
it
too.
It was. It
yeah.
was.
Yeah. One of these days, we're going to, you keep saying that you're going to sit me down and have me watch these movies with you. And
wait, you've never seen Star Wars?
I've seen bits and pieces
all right,
of the
all
various
right.
ones.
Well, Beverly just told me she's never seen Braveheart. So I got a lot of movies
oh
to
my
show
gosh.
A lot of people. I know.
Freedom.
It's fine.
Of course.
I'm ready. I'm ready.
You ready for Louise Bourgeois Bouzier?
I really just want her name to be Louise Bourgeois Bourgeois, though. I have to confess, like, I so badly want that.
Bourgeois Bourgeois. Not much is known about the beginning part and the end part of her life.
Okay.
Because this is the mid-16th century. We know about her when she really starts working.
Yeah.
And then there's some, we'll talk about why we don't know much about the end
okay.
of her life a little bit later.
Fair, fair.
So she's born comfortably well off in 1563
All right.
as Louise Bourgeois. We know that she was taught to read and write, so
nice.
She was at least middle class, but
nice.
She didn't know Latin, so we know that she wasn't in the French like aristocracy, like the upper crust.
So she people. Wasn't bourgeois bourgeois.
So she was, yes, exactly. So she was,
gotcha.
She was somewhere in there.
Okay.
Her family lived near this army surgeon / barber. His name was Martin Bouzier. For some reason, barbers and medical surgeons for a long time throughout history were very closely
yeah.
connected.
Oh, yeah. I could talk a lot about that because, you know, I read
we should do a lady
of,
bit about it.
About medical history things. Well, the barber, uh-huh. the barber pole, you know,
right?
The symbol for
it's
that
blood.
Is
it's
supposed to
be
blood.
Blood.
Like they would tie the bloody ribbons around a pole to just dry them out because nobody believed that somebody else's blood could infect you with anything.
It can't.
There's no germs.
No,
what are you talking about?
All.
Tiny little things that float around in the air and make people sick? You crazy.
Stop speaking of the devil.
That's crazy.
It's heretical.
Yeah.
So they live, they marry in 1584 and Louise would have been about 21.
Okay.
And they settled in Saint-Germain, which is on the outskirts of Paris. This is basically all we know about
cool.
her early life. And this is until October 31st, 1589, when Henry of Navarre, there's a civil war happening in France at the time.
Of course.
Henry is marching his way towards Paris to become the future King Henry IV.
Okay.
Father to Louis VIII. And this big battle forces Louise and her children to flee to the city, basically abandoning all of their possessions.
Okay.
And her husband at the time is tending to sick people on the battlefield.
Right.
Because he's a
right.
surgeon / barber. So they lose basically everything. And
oh,
because
man.
Of all the upheaval and everything, they have to end up selling the bulk of what they have left
Ooh.
To keep things going.
Yeah.
And Louise turns to needlework, which is a skill that she'd learned when she was younger,
yeah.
To put food on the table. But it wasn't enough. And
oh,
her
really?
Husband's medical practice wasn't enough either.
Oh.
And so she's in the middle of giving birth to her final child, and the midwife that's helping her, attending to her, mentions that if she had known how to write and how to read, that she could have done amazing things with her skills at this time. And so
Snaps.
This little
Snaps.
Light bulb goes off in Louise's brain, and she notices a need for good, proper midwives in her community.
Oh, men left women out of the medical profession. Wow, deja vu.
Well, actually, some interesting information about contemporary
yeah.
midwifing during
yep,
this
yep.
time. The French had only begun officially licensing midwives in 1563,
oh, Lord.
Which is about 30 years prior to the period that we're talking about
oh,
right
man.
Now. And it was actually surgeons who were made to oversee the training of midwives, not physicians, not everyday physicians, because it was such an invasive practice.
Right. Okay.
This is actually, in France, a marked difference from how this was practiced in Italy and England, for example,
yeah.
where it was the church who was responsible for seeing to the certification of midwives And their main concerns were the religious and moral responsibilities of childbirth than their actual medical expertise. So a lot of the traditions of midwifery were oral traditions, and they were very kind of superstitious and woo-woo, exactly.
Is that where... Have you ever heard the joke about, you know, whenever someone's giving birth in a movie, everyone's like, in an old-timey movie.
Right.
You know, if it's in a contemporary movie, it's always in an elevator. We know this.
Or on the side of the road somewhere.
Somewhere horrific. You know, in a bathtub, and you can't make a sound or the creatures will kill you. We've all seen this.
Yeah.
But there's a joke, you know, any period piece film, somebody's giving birth, everyone's like, boil some water. And it's like, what are you going to do with that? Right. That helps nothing.
She talks at one point in one
of
her books.
Just drink some whiskey.
She talks at one point. And it's funny. You read a lot of these excerpts from this book. She writes this book eventually, which we'll get to in a minute.
Right.
That is essentially her giving this advice to these midwives. It's to our ears. It's very like...
Duh. Yeah.
For example, one of the things that she talks about is the woman in labor does not want to be lying down. Don't hold her down. She said, I have seen so many childbirths go bad because the mother or some other female relative was forcing the woman to stay in prone.
Right.
She said, if the woman wants to get up and walk around and she can get up and walk around, let her walk around.
Yeah. And yeah, a lot of contemporary to today's doctors and thoughts about birth, I think, don't allow that as much.
It's interesting. And, you know, she publishes this book in 1606. It's a full 64 years before we get a piece or a book or a writing that is similar to this in England. And it's another 30 years after that we get something of the sort in Germany.
Wow.
So she really is like at the cutting edge, coming in right on the ground floor of midwifery. The licensing of midwives, of course, is a double-edged sword for women at the same time, we should note. Because, of course, for those who could pass muster, you are a license gives you status. It gives you job security. It gives you access to guild positions, so unions, essentially. Yeah. But on the other hand, those who couldn't pass muster were now being shut out or banned from a profession which had been historically female for... Centuries. And in fact, a register from 1601 shows that there were only 60 registered midwives during that time.
Wow.
So on November 12th, 1598, Louise sits for a panel made up of a physician as the chairperson, two surgeons, and two experienced midwives. Up to this point, she had been studying her husband's books. She had been asking her husband if she had any questions.
Yeah.
And for about 5 years, she was just out in her surrounding communities delivering babies, giving out medical advice, and helping her community before she sits down for this panel.
Wow.
According to some of the research that I found, the midwives on this panel weren't exactly easy on Louise, primarily because they saw her as competition.
Right. Go figure.
But she passed. Of course. Nice. So newly minted as an official midwife, her certification now allowed her to attend the births of the French nobility and the aristocracy. And she moves her family to the Rue Saint-André de Haute, which I guess is a street in Paris.
Great. Awesome.
And she begins to find clients among the wealthy. And word quickly spreads because of her skill and her professionalism. One of the other things that she writes about in her book is how important it is for a midwife to keep her cool. And while everyone else is freaking out, you have to not show surprise at anything. Even if you are surprised, you need to stay calm.
Be a producer.
Breathe.
Everything is fine.
It's fine.
Everything is fine.
It could be burning down around you, but it's fine.
Yeah. Nothing is not solvable.
Right. I think the quote says, nothing is worse than seeing a household at sixes and sevens, which is...
I am putting that on my wall.
Her big moment comes in 1601. Now, having become king in 1589, the newly minted King Henry IV marries Marie de Medici, of Italian family fame. Right. They marry in 1600 and they're expecting their first child by 1601.
Good work, Marie.
For real, though. Hey, King Henry had it in his mind that he was going to hire this other midwife named Madame Dupuis to be the royal midwife, having had some experiences with her services in the past, delivering the children of his mistresses, his illegitimate gotcha. Children. Now, unfortunately, a couple things were impeding Madame Dupuis' ascendance to this position. One, she had delivered the mistress's
right.
children, and the queen didn't much care to be reminded of that fact.
Yeah, during that's her own, perfectly fair.
During her own birth.
Fair, fair.
And actually, the most recent birth that she'd attended to, the mistress had actually died afterwards. So one of the king's personal physicians advocated for Louise, as well as a lot of the other ladies at the court who Louise had been attending to their births right. as well. So the moment of truth comes, September 26th, 1601, in a room, of course, packed with court attendants and visiting right. aristocrats. Talk about you must keep your cool mm-hmm. while delivering a future king of France and surrounded by every person.
Yeah, it's not like
anyone.
If something goes wrong, they're going to just chop your head
right,
off.
Right.
Casual.
She's actually, the story goes that in this instance, she had to ask the king for permission to dribble a little bit of wine into the baby's mouth from her own mm-hmm. mouth, and the baby was fussing. And she successfully and nobly delivers the future King Charles.
Wow.
King Louis, excuse me. After the future King Louis VIII is born, Louise goes on to deliver five more of Marie's children.
Wow.
This is Elizabeth, who's a future queen of Spain, Christina of Savoy, the Duke d'Anjou, Henrietta Maria, who's the future queen of England. She marries the ill-fated Charles I.
Mm.
And a fifth child who is a boy who actually had been born in Breach. Louise was widely acclaimed for delivering the boy right. successfully, but unfortunately he died during infancy.
Gotcha.
For each boy delivered, she received a sum of 500 to 900 crowns.
Woo!
Now, it's hard finding the currency converters.
Right.
But if we're going by gold content, this is worth about $7,000 to $11,000.
Whoa!
In today's money.
Whoa!
Yeah. for each boy.
Wow.
Because, of course, she's working not just at the birth, but the whole period of confinement for the mother. But still...
Hey-o.
That's a good amount of money.
Oh, I'm
especially
go
when, each child normally would get about 50 crowns
right.
for delivering a child. She's getting 500 to 900. And for each girl, she got 300 crowns. It's like 7,000. In 1606, she's officially given the title of midwife to the queen. In 1608, she's given a bonus of 6,000 crowns.
Whoa!
Which is the equivalent of about $130,000.
Yeah.
And it also, I found this really cool converter that not only converted to money, but it also did some fancy math that converted it to like hours worked and like what that would translate to in terms of if you were making that like per hour.
Okay.
And this was the equivalent of an American worker making about $2.2 million in terms of labor costs.
Wow.
So this is quite a lot of money.
Great.
For being midwife to the queen.
Love it.
In 1609, then, she's awarded an annual pension from the king for services rendered to the crown
Great.
Of 300 crowns.
Great.
So she's getting about 7,000. She asked for 600, and the king said, you can have three. This is the year she publishes her first major work. It's called Diverse Observations on Sterility, Loss of the Ovum After Fecundation, Fecundity and Childbirth, Diseases of Women and of Newborn Infants.
Wow.
Very long title. It's published in 1609. This is the first treatise on midwifery that we know of in the modern
That's
age.
Crazy.
It included practical information on midwifery that arguably singularly advanced the practice of midwifery as no one had done before. It was translated into Latin, German, Dutch, and English.
Wow.
It went through several editions and was the textbook to use for the better part of the next 100 years.
Wow.
So, needless to say, her practice flourished.
Right.
Some accounts have her attending about 3 to 4 births a week on Ooh. Average. Yeah. She writes a couple more books in the intervening years. She writes two different books called Diverse Observations in 1617 and 1626, one of which contains the first ever prescription for iron to treat anemia.
Wow.
She publishes a book called The Collection of Secrets after Ooh. This next event that we're going to talk about, which is an anecdotal book based on her experiences. These books contained not only her observations and teachings on midwifery, but also her views on other things as well. So she gives advice on epilepsy, rabies, toothaches, headaches, chest problems, fevers, the plague, and kidney and liver problems for both men and women. In one book,
that is a laundry list.
That is quite a lot. In one book, there's a chapter titled Advice to My Daughter. And she tells her daughter, quote, to fear God, to attend the poor with charity, and to never let unmarried women into her house for confinement or to assist in abortions. So great, great left turn. Not so great, not so great.
Yeah.
She also
Although, I'm just going to be the devil's advocate over here. Sure. And just say, in the 1600s, yes. I'm going to go out on a limb here, just a limb, and say abortions were probably pretty dangerous.
Oh my gosh,
and so
yes.
Probably it's less about
yes.
family planning or a woman's right to choose and more about, like, I don't want you to let a stranger kill you.
Right. Right. Or I don't want you to
right.
accidentally kill someone else.
Yeah. Or kill yourself.
Right.
By accident.
Right. And letting an unmarried woman in to give right. birth in your house would probably not be very good for anyone involved. Anyway.
Going on.
I want to read one quick passage
that
I found from encyclopedia.com because it helps to kind of show
yeah.
her eventual decline.
Okay.
And this is what it says. It says, she likened the midwife's role to that of a ship's pilot, working with natural forces rather than becoming ensnared in a futile quest to overpower them.
Hmm.
In her first book, Bourgeois praised doctors and extolled the virtues of cooperation between physician and midwife. But as her fame grew, she adopted a more confrontational stance. She applied, at one point, that one doctor who had intervened surgically in a different birth had done so with an eye to the fee he would thus be able to charge, an idea with a familiar ring in the early 21st century.
Right.
Although it is difficult to know exactly what happened at a distance of nearly 400 years, it seemed that bad blood began to grow between bourgeois and the doctors who operated at the top levels of the Parisian medical world.
Makes sense.
Though technically retired as a midwife, Louise participates in the delivery of the child of, it's either the Duchess of Orléans or it's Marie de Bourbon in 1627. Either way, this is a relation to the king.
Right.
And unfortunately, the mother dies in childbirth, and an autopsy reveals that it was caused by an infection because, according to the autopsy panel, a piece of the placenta was left inside the womb.
Oh.
I believe this is called peritonitis.
Okay.
Or something like that. And the autopsy panel was, of course, presided over by the male physicians
right.
who had been so cruelly maligned by
right.
Louise.
I see where this is going.
And while they didn't name her outright, they heavily implied that the infection that had killed the mother was caused by malpractice
right.
on Louise's part. So not one, of course, to let her own story be written for her. 3 days after the autopsy board delivers these findings, she releases this blistering letter called The Apology of Louise Bourgeois.
Snap! Talk about a clapback!
Here's my apology. Go Ooh. To hell. And she says, quote, by your report, you expose your utter ignorance of what constitutes a woman's afterbirth, whether before or after labor. And I have, quote, I have practiced my possession now fully 34 years, faithfully, diligently, and honorably, and acquired not only a good certificate after various examinations, but have also written books treating on this subject, for which trouble many noted physicians have rendered me thanks and have gladly confessed that they were of great use to humanity. That's a quote.
Yep.
The panel responds with their own pamphlet, but unfortunately, this whole controversy had the effect of essentially reducing her influence.
Yeah.
And she lives out the rest of her life in, you know, historical obscurity.
Right.
I mean, I say historical because we don't know.
Yeah.
We don't really have history on her. We know that she publishes The Collection of Secrets, this final book, in 1634. And then we know that she passed away 2 years later in 1636 at the age of 73. That's all we know.
Pretty incredible.
Yeah, I agree. And you know what I love about her story is that she just like, you know, just like your woman.
Yeah.
She suffered an event that was out of her control, that by all circumstances, by all means, should have destroyed her future opportunities.
Yeah.
And she said, not today, Satan. I'm going to go do, you know, with the support of a man right. that was close to her.
Right. And I would say, too, I just love in the old timey world when people just publish things at each other. It's very yes. similar. I was thinking to people tweeting things at each other, yeah. like a Twitter feud.
Yeah.
Except on parchment, bitch.
Well, we still do this. If you look, Congress does this.
Yeah.
Every time the chairman of the Senate Armed Service right. Committee releases a letter to the Secretary of Defense, and right. it's carefully worded and on this beautiful parchment, and it is...
It's crazy.
I live for it. Clap back in a letter.
Hey friends, if you are enjoying listening to this podcast and learning tons about history, women's history, medical history, do us a favor and leave us a review on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, wherever you listen and wherever you can leave us a rating or a review. It helps other people find the show, which helps us keep doing the show. Thanks.
Hey friends, if you're looking for that thing to show the world that you listen to the Bitchery of History,
Or some cool holiday gifts,
you should check out bitcheryofhistory.com and go to that shop. Fun fact, free shipping on 3 stickers or more anywhere in the United States.
Love it.
Yes.
So speaking of book writing.
Yes.
My last short and sweet woman is... Rebecca Crumpler. Mm-hmm. She was born in 1831 in Delaware to Absalom Davis and Matilda Weber.
And
Davis was her name.
Quick side note, apologies to the for the my neighbors who are
doing yard work.
Lawn blowing something.
She had an aunt in Pennsylvania who spent much of her time caring for sick neighbors and may have influenced her career choice. Mm-hmm. Her aunt is the woman who raised Rebecca.
Okay.
And by 1852, she had moved to Charlestown, Massachusetts. And there she worked as a nurse for 8 years because the first formal school for nursing only opened in 1873. She was able to perform work without any formal training.
Here you go.
No school. However, in 1860, she was admitted into the New England Female Medical College. And she graduated in 1864. She was the first African-American woman in the United States to earn an MD degree and the only African-American woman to graduate from the New England Female Medical College, which closed in 1873. Oh, so like, maybe there would be more, but it's one of those things where it's like, I'm the first and the only because you can't do it anymore.
Talk about being at the right place at the right time.
Dr. Crumpler practiced in Boston for a short while, and then she moved to Richmond, Virginia after the Civil War ended in 1865 because she felt it would be, quote, a proper field for real missionary work and one that would present ample opportunities to become acquainted with the diseases of women and children.
Okay.
I mean, can't really argue with that. She joined other black physicians caring for freed slaves who would otherwise have no access to medical care.
Mm-hmm.
She was working with the Freedmen's Bureau and other missionary and community groups, even though black physicians, of course, experienced intense racism working in the post-war
no.
South. Go figure. Now, it was while she was living still in Massachusetts that she married Wyatt Lee, a Virginia native and a former slave. And they were married in 1852, but while she was a medical student, Wyatt died of tuberculosis.
Ay, ay, ay.
So that's why then she earned her medical degree under the name Rebecca Lee.
Mm.
However, in New Brunswick, in St. John, New Brunswick, she married Arthur Crumpler, also a former slave from Virginia. And so that's why she's known as Rebecca Lee Crumpler when, in 1883, she published a book of medical discourses. And that is the title, A Book of Medical Discourses.
Girl, come on.
It was dedicated to nurses and mothers. It focused on the medical care of women and children and was one of the first publications written by an African American about medicine, in addition to being the only female physician author in the 19th century.
Oh my God.
You're welcome. The Rebecca Lee Society, one of the first medical societies for African American women, was named in her honor. Her home on Joy Street is a stop on the Boston Women's Heritage Trail.
Wow.
At Syracuse University, there is a pre-health club named the Rebecca Lee Pre-Health Society. And this club is there to encourage people with all different types of backgrounds to get involved with health professions and schools. Mm-hmm. They offer mentors from all kinds of medical practices, workshops, and resources so that students are able to succeed from any background. Yeah. Rebecca Lee Crumpler died in 1895 in Fairview, Massachusetts. Mm. And she and her husband, Arthur, are both buried at the Fairview Cemetery. Arthur died in 1910.
Wow. Very cool.
Yeah. Another short and sweet, but also very similar
Absolutely.
To Louise, publishing books on medicine.
And practicing as an African-American doctor at the Civil War time?
Just after the Civil War ended, yeah.
Jesus.
Right?
Lord. Speaking about all these doctors that we're covering today, cause of the week?
The American Red Cross.
Yes.
Classic. We've done it a couple of times, mm-hmm. but since California has turned into Mordor.
Oh, we shouldn't laugh. It's really all you can do at this point, isn't it?
Pretty much. Shout out to Beverly Jean for that joke. Since California has gone through so many wildfires, the American Red Cross is, of course, as they always do, gathering funds, distributing supplies, taking care of people. So we wanted to highlight them again as another great cause of the week. You can visit them at their website, redcross.org. You can donate. You can probably even find volunteer situations mm-hmm. in your area. Blood drives are always a good thing to do.
Yeah. One of the things that has really kind of made my heart swell in the last couple of weeks, not just from the fires, but also from the shooting that happened, of course, has just been watching the people of this state come together to help each other.
And you can help too. Redcross.org.
Amen. I guess that'll do it for another episode of The Bitchery of History.
Thanks for sticking around with us, learning about medical history, one of my favorite subjects.
Yes.
As always, we could not make this show happen without our incredible team. There's Sydney,
Jess,
Kim,
and Jeanette.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And of course, to you, our wonderful, wonderful listeners.
Yes. If you'd like to stay in contact with us, find us on Facebook. Just search The Bitchery of History.
Same for Instagram and Twitter.
Just search The Bitchery of History.
We're on all those social medias.
Yes.
And remember,
bitches get stuff done.